I fought a good fight. I finished my football race. And after 18 years, it's time.
Basketball players, we're really supposed to shut up and dribble, but I'm glad we did a little bit more than that.
Eventually, every ball would go flat, but that doesn't mean that your life will flatline. What will you do when the game is over?
Okay, all. Welcome to episode 45 of The Endless Hustle. I am your host, Matt Cohan, and I am also joined by my co-host, Arthur Cade. Today we have a doubleheader, and it is a very good doubleheader. We have a real-life superhero and a fake-life superhero, don't we, Artie?
We do. In fact, George St. Pierre is both of those, actually, now, funny enough. One of the greatest UFC fighters, if not the greatest of all time, also starring now in Disney Plus's The Falcon and the Winter Soldier. How cool is that, Matt? And then our second one is Harry Lennix, just great veteran actor, been in a million things. Currently, he's on Blacklist, but he also made an appearance in Zack Snyder's Justice League, and he's Martian Manhunter. It was a big reveal. We can actually now discuss it as a spoiler alert, but he's Martian Manhunter because he's been posting all about it. So Harry Lennix is veteran actor. People are discovering him not only for his hit show, but also his appearance as a superhero in the DC universe. So we have Marvel DC in this episode colliding together.
Yeah, I mean, it really is amazing. Never underestimate, we released a clip earlier, never underestimate the fanfare of Justice League. It is absolutely wild. It was evident in kind of Harry Lennix, who's been an actor for over three decades, and you could just see how excited he was to be part of something that is so ubiquitous in the culture. So, you know, it was great to have him on and pick his brain about, you know, just how his life has been since this has really taken off.
Yeah, we'll start with George. George is obviously our first guest. He retired from the UFC in 2019. And he has his eye on Hollywood right now. I mean, we've seen, Matt, so many wrestlers and fighters who have made this successful transition to Hollywood, whether it's The Rock, John Cena, Dave Bautista. Now St. Pierre is the latest. I mean, he had this appearance in Captain America, The Winter Soldier. He's now in Falcon and The Winter Soldier. And as he embarks on this new chapter in his life, it's funny because you can almost forget how dominant a fighter he was in the MMA world. He was a two-time welterweight champion and middleweight champion, 26 wins throughout his career, again, considered one of the GOATs. But it was also fascinating because in this interview, and this was my favorite moment, he gave us a tour of his house. We got to see his samurai swords and his dinosaur heads. He talked about what it was like and why he got into karate, what it was like being bullied as a child, which think about a guy who has submitted the greatest fighters in the world, was bullied as a child, and then also his love of paleontology. We kind of went everywhere with George. I love this dude. And his electricity as a personality, you can just tell the guy's going to go places in Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, he's soft-spoken, but he's thoughtful. I really enjoy George, so I'm not going to hold you guys up anymore. This is George St. Pierre. Okay, so this is a great day on Endless Hustle today, Artie, as we invite on two division champion and one of the best mixed martial artists ever, George St. Pierre. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
No worries. You know, George, you're sneaky becoming a Hollywood A-lister with your latest role in The Falcon and the Winter Soldier. So congratulations on that. I thought you were getting too Hollywood to join the show. So
hey, thank you. Disney contacted me and I was able to reprise my role of Batroc the Leaper. And I've done some roles in the past, but I was busy competing. And I'm a little bit obsessive compulsive by nature. So when I do something, I really want to be the best. I become obsessed by it. And that's how I did with my fighting career. But now it's been 2 years that I turned into acting. I've been working very hard every week since then in order to improve my game of acting. So I'm very glad with how the show has been going so far.
I'd have to imagine life as an actor is a lot less stressful than in the octagon. Would that be safe to assume?
Well, if you zig when you shoot a zag in fighting, you can be badly hurt, you know, and badly humiliated. In acting, if you zig when you shoot, if you messed up, cut, we'll do it again. So the outcome is not as dramatic as it is in fighting, of course.
I have so many questions to ask you. By the way, Matt, I hated your introduction. You could have just been like, goat. The goat is here. That's it. Simple.
I'm not going to pump his tire. He knows. Goat. Come on.
The goat is here. That's all. Two division champion, the goat. George, I got to ask you, what is above your left shoulder? That looks like a gladiator's vest.
It's a samurai. It's a samurai vest. You know, like I have a lot of stuff here. Like I collection a lot of stuff. I have samurai sword. I have the dinosaurs fossil. I got all sorts of things. So I choose the samurai armor right there for this one.
I love it. He switches backgrounds depending on which show, how aggressive he needs to get.
Absolutely. I just been told to change my background for Yahoo Finance because I have the dinosaurs in the background and they were like, do you have something more subtle? I was like, yeah, of course. So I move around my house with the camera and came here.
I think forget the interview. I think I just want a house tour of George St. Pierre's house, like dinosaur bones everywhere. I can't even imagine what's going on there.
Well, if you want, I can give you a tour real fast.
Love to see it.
Yeah, now I'm almost like curious now.
Let's do it. I'm going to do it.
Oh shit, we're actually getting a tour of George St. Pierre's house.
All right. Start with a mask. It's a mask that comes from Congo. It's a sorcerer mask and it's supposed to protect me. Its name is Mutombo. I receive it as a gift.
Oh wow.
This samurai sword right there.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna show you one very cool stuff I have in my place here.
By the way, I'm kind of digging. Oh my god, it's like Cage dinosaur heads. I love it.
This is guys, a mosasaur. Say a mosasaur.
Oh my god. Wait, so that was too provocative for Yahoo Finance?
This is a megalodon tooth. And one of the biggest regrets in my life in terms of materialism is that was a very big megalodon tooth. And when I fixed my audio system, it fell on the ground and shattered in pieces. And that's only what's left of it, unfortunately.
Did you pay for all that stuff or was that given?
Of course, some I received as a gift. Some I bought it myself because I study paleontology. I love paleontology. It's my passion.
Wow. Amazing.
You've got such a cool story. You're a bouncer, a garbage man. I mean, you have all these odd jobs. And then you decide, all right, I'm going to take this MMA thing really seriously. When did it actually transition and become your career?
Well, I first started martial arts first because of, as a self-defense, because I was bullied at school. But I realized I was very good at it. So I started collectioning medals. It started as a self-defense, then a passion, and the passion became a business, you know? So I think when I was about 15, 16 years old, I saw the first UFC with Royce Gracie. And at the time, there was no weight class, almost no rules. And I see this little guy, Royce Gracie, beating all his opponent that looks way more intimidating than he was. And it makes me remember how I was when I was getting bullied at school. So I became very, he really inspired me because I wanted to be like him. And that's when I told all my friends when I was a teenager, I'm going to get into UFC and become champion. And they all laughed at me.
Do you remember the first time you stood up to someone physically, you know, outside of the karate studio?
Yeah, but unfortunately for me, when I was bullied at school, things didn't really go my way. In my professional career, I'm having a great record, but in the street, back in the day at school, I have a losing record, unfortunately. So yeah, it was a long process. I was able to get out of bullying. Not because I wish I could tell you like a Hollywood scenario that I beat up all the bullies, but it did not happen like that to me. Martial art taught me confidence. And I believe the reason why I was getting picked on, it's because growing up, I was a kid who lacked a lot of confidence. And like in nature, the predatory animal always hunt the prey that looks the weakest. And bullies are the same way. So they were picking on me because I looked very weak, and I was weak. But martial art taught me confidence, how to to be more confident and carry myself with more confidence. And that's how I get rid of bullying over time, not because I beat them up on it.
Do you realize there's people walking around Canada right now talking about how they once beat up George St. Pierre, one of the UFC greats, and they're like, I kicked his ass in high school.
Yeah, they did. They really did. But let me tell you, when I was in high school, I was a kid, they had a delinquent program in my school. And these kids, they were kids that used to redo their grade maybe two to three times. So they were much older than me and much bigger than me. And sometimes they were waiting like two, three kids for me after school. So instead of focusing on what the teacher was explaining in front of the class, I was focusing on how I'm going to get to my locker, grab my books, reach the bus without getting beat up. So it was a long time, and I don't hold any grudge to them. And I believe that being bullied as a kid made me stronger and get me prepared for the mental warfare that I had to face later in my life in mixed martial art, because there's a lot of trash talk in mixed martial art. And now, because I was bullied as a kid, when I was older in mixed martial art, I was mentally more stronger to deal with mental warfare in the fight game.
George, obviously at the top of the interview, I was joking around about the GOAT stuff, but you are in the conversation for potentially being the GOAT. How much do you think about that? Is that something that you kind of take a step back and think about your legacy at this point, now that you've potentially finished your career?
Well, when I was competing, I had like three stages in my career in terms of evolution. Before, I wanted to become the best ever. I wanted to change, do things that could change the sport forever and being remembered forever. Then during the time that I was champion, I wanted to stay hungry and accomplish more. You know, I wanted to make sure, like, I was no longer at one point competing against the guy that I was fighting. I was competing with the other guys who were competing for the great, the most victory in title fights and stuff like that, with guys that were competing. I was competing against in a parallel in terms of success, you know. But then after I retired and time passed by, and I realized that every sport, it's promoted in a way that it's about what's next. It's not what happened before. It's about what's next. And I truly believe that the fighters of today are better than the fighters of yesterday. And the fighters of tomorrow, as good as there are the fighters today, as the fighters of tomorrow will be better than the one of today. And if you don't believe me, just look at the 100 meter. Every few years, the record get broken. Usain Bolt was great, but one day there will come a guy that will beat his record in the 100 meter, and mixed martial art is no different.
Interesting. Yeah, you recently said that the act of fighting was unbearable and that you actually hated it. Were you able to sleep soundly the night before fights? Because sometimes I get the Sunday scaries just before the beginning of a work week, which is pathetic.
I never slept well before a fight. The only time I slept well before a fight is when I got knocked out by Matt Serra. So it was not a good thing. But I think now, with the experience I have in terms of competition, I know for a fact that being afraid, it's a good thing. Fear can be bad if it paralyzes you. It's like fire, you know, like it can burn you, but it can also help you cook your food. So fear, I know for a fact that fear enhances my reaction time, my power. It makes me sharper, more focused. So I like to be scared going into a fight. It's a necessary evil. However, it takes a toll on me on the long terms. And that's why I never like to fight, because the idea of getting badly hurt or humiliated, it's unbearable for me. People always ask me, why did you do it then? Because I guess I like to win better than I hate to lose. And I was just very good at it. I made a lot of money. It gave me access of things that people don't have. And I have the freedom. But in order to keep that freedom, I needed to fight. And that's why I did it. Not because I love to fight. I hate to fight. I love the science of martial art, to train. But to compete, it's very stressful.
I was at dinner with three of my buddies on Saturday, George, and we are all MMA fans, and we literally almost got into a fight ourselves
we were debating the virtual fight of George St. Pierre in his prime versus Khabib in his prime. It finished up 2-2 that me and a buddy said GSP wins and the other two buddies said Khabib wins. And we were going back and forth, playing out the fight, rounds, styles. It was crazy. What do you think in your prime versus Khabib in his prime? How does that fight play out?
Well, I'm going to answer this by being the most objective as I can and not subjective. What I can tell you is in basketball, in baseball, in football, it's not always the best team that wins the game. It's the team that play the best the night of the game. Fighting is no different. It's not the fighter, the best fighter that wins the fight. It's the fighter that fight the best the night of the fight. So even though I believe I'm better than him, I don't know what would have been the outcome. It's only one way to find out.
You're the greatest defensive fighter of all time. I don't think he would get his hands on you. I think you would win. Five-round decision, I said. That was my prediction.
You said there's only one way to find out. You got to come out of retirement.
I'm getting too old for this, guys. I'm 39 years old, you know?
And He's just a number. Tom Brady's 59.
Yeah, but Tom Brady is a quarterback. You know, he's an amazing athlete. You know, he's got the brain. And I'm not Tom Brady. You know, Tom Brady, he's unbelievable. You know, and mixed martial art is a different sport, you know? So, and I always wanted to retire from the sport, and I didn't want the sport to retire me. Like a lot of fighters, they make that mistake. They stay too long in there because you can say I play baseball, play football, but you don't play fighting. So the you have a window which in you need you can compete, but after that, your time is past. There's something that no athlete can beat. It's time. When your time is up, get out of here. You know.
George, where do you stand on intermittent fasting? I know you completed the 75-hour water fast in 2019 and took a crack at the one-week one you had to abandon. Can you walk us through what your body and mind goes through during these challenges and if you still keep up with it in retirement?
Yeah. I cannot recommend fasting to anybody because, I'm not a doctor. And also, everybody is different. Everybody has different physiology and health issues, you know. But for me, fasting did great. It changed my life on a positive way. Four times a year, I do what we call a prolonged fasting. At least I go more than 3 days without consuming any calories. And I still train during those 3 days. I drink water and Himalayan salt. I was diagnosed 2 years ago, more than 2 years ago, with a condition called ulcerative colitis. And fasting helped me get rid of all my symptoms. You know, it really changed my life. And it also, I believe it boosts my immune system, reduced my inflammation, water retention, and it makes me sharper. Sometimes when I'm fasting, I feel like physically my muscle fire better sometimes, and I don't carry as much water retention, so I feel lighter on my feet, and it helps me be more lean as well. So there's a lot of good advantage to fast, but everybody does it for different reasons.
I know you're a huge Karate Kid fan and also love Cobra Kai, and Cobra Kai is one of my favorite shows, by the way. Now that you're making waves in Hollywood, is that something you would love to be part of? Are you reaching out to Ralph Macchio and saying, hey, find me a role on Cobra Kai?
Man, I would love this. It's Karate Kid is one of the movies that inspire me. You know, a kid that got bullied at school. You know, that's my story. You know, a little bit. But yeah, I'm a big fan of Cobra Kai. I've seen it all. You know, I've seen the show, and I hope they're gonna come up with another season.
They are. Another person who meant actually a lot to me and who I loved growing up was Jean-Claude Van Damme. Oh, and yeah. I don't know why, but you give me this like Jean-Claude Van Damme vibe. And I talk to you, it could be the accent, but what was Jean-Claude Van Damme for you growing up? Was that someone that you looked up to as well?
His movie Bloodsport is probably one of the reasons why I've started martial art. It really inspired me. And the fact also that he comes from a French background, he's Belgian, you know, like he speaks French, but we don't speak the same French, you know, my French. The French I speak, it's Canadian French. is much different than the French from France or Belgium, you know? So, but we can understand each other. And he's an inspiration, you know? And when I was young, I was watching all his movie and I got a chance to see him and train with him. So I'm very happy to have a chance to meet an idol like Jean-Claude Van Damme.
All right, so I have two follow-up questions on this. And I've always wondered this about Jean-Claude Van Damme. Can he actually fight in real life? I mean, or is it just all movie cinematic stuff with the splits and the, you know, what is he really like as a fighter in real life?
I got that question a lot by a lot of people. And I believe there's three different ways that you can be a martial artist. You can be a martial artist by doing competition. You know, you can be a top martial artist by competing, like I did. You know, I did it in competition. You can be a top martial artist by doing choreography. Like you see, like some of the kata form or stunt doubles, they're incredible in choreography. And you can be very good in philosophy. For example, like Bruce Lee, he changed the world with his philosophy. You know what I mean? And I believe Jean-Claude Van Damme is a good fighter, but he's mostly good in choreography. You know, that's how he contributes the most to the world of martial art. Bruce Lee was a philosopher, you know, and so far for me, for example, a guy like me or Anderson Silva was a competitor. So there's three different branches, I would say, that are included in martial art that you can be in, you know, that like you're not 100% all the way on one, you know, you can be but there's always one that you're more than the others.
My other follow-up question was, can you do the split that he did in Bloodsport?
Man, I've tried for so many years. That's one of the greatest failures of my life. I since I'm a kid, I tried to do this in between two chairs. I've tried for so many years, and I've tried, and I tried, and even pushed myself to the limit so many times, and it never works. I came close, but it's like my physique is blocked. I cannot do it. I just don't know. And it's not because I didn't put enough effort. And trust me, I really tried, but I was never able to do the big split like Jean-Claude Van Damme. I wish I could, but no.
Arthur, how can you call him the goat? He can't even do a split.
What a failure of a career this has been.
Yeah, it's like a fantasy for me. You know, there are certain fantasy things that. Physically, I wanted to do, but I have no longer this illusion. I know that for a fact. Now I'm getting older, and things it's not gonna get as good. My physicality will go down, and I probably will never be able to achieve it.
I hear you, George. George, you mentioned earlier about the athletes in MMA going to continue to evolve, and what I think you meant by that was YouTuber Jake Paul, who of course is taking on Ben Askren next month. Dana White said that he'd bet $1 million that Askren pulls it out, but Mike Perry thinks Jake is going to shock the world here. Have you been following this? And if so, what is your prediction on the fight?
Well, I didn't know that fight was taking place first. I heard rumors, but I didn't know it was
April 17th.
Wow. So listen, if it would be a mixed martial art fight, Jake Paul would have zero chance. I mean, it would be done because Askren's strength is his wrestling. He's a very good wrestler. He even compete to the Olympics. However, in boxing, now you really take Ben Askren outside of his comfort zone. But Askren is training with Freddie Roach now. Freddie Roach, I know he's my coach. And if one guy can improve Ben Askren's boxing skills, it's Freddie Roach. So for that reason, I believe Askren gonna win.
George, when you were part of UFC and you saw it exploding, did you have an idea of what it would become at that point? Because you were really at the beginning of the evolution of what's now become a multi-billion dollar industry. Could you visualize where it was going?
I don't want to sound arrogant, but the answer is yes. And the reason is there's a lot of sports, like, for example, basketball, hockey, football. There are certain sports that are made for a certain person. And I understand that fighting is not a form of entertainment that is made for everybody. However, everybody can relate to fighting. And the reason is this, I can take everybody, even the nicest person in the world, like for example, my mom would never hurt nobody. She will never hurt, not even hurt a fly. But I can put her in a situation where she will be forced to fight for to defend herself or defend people that she loved. So fighting is someone that everything can relate to. And even if you go watch a baseball game and there's a fight that breaks out in the crowd, you will stop watching the baseball game and watch the fight because it's threatening you. So it's part of our DNA. And I think that's for this reason that fighting is very popular amongst people. You know, like it's something that everybody can relate to. However, it's not everybody who could fight well. You know what I mean? But everybody can relate to this.
One of the themes on this podcast is to find out how successful people like you continue to elevate and find meaning in their lives. Now that you're retired, what habits do you incorporate into your life that keep you motivated and fulfilled?
Yeah, now I turn myself into acting. And like in my professional career in fighting, I believe in order to improve, I need to get out of my comfort zone and work there, work very hard. And that's what I've been doing for the last 2 years. It started with the series, the Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and it's a new beginning for me, a new career. And like I'm very obsessed with stuff that I care about, and I really put a lot of energy and effort in. And hopefully it will go great, and I will see what the future holds for me.
Before we let you go, George, I want to talk about Falcon and Winter Soldier. To be part of that franchise, to be part of Marvel, and to be part of this universe, what does it mean to you, and what can people expect?
Man, it's a dream come true. Marvel, Disney, I've always been a huge fan of them, and it doesn't get bigger than this, you know? And to be able to shoot, to be on set with Anthony Mackie, he's an amazing actor, someone who's very charismatic, he always make laugh everybody on set. It's just amazing. I had the chance to work with the director, Carrie Strugglin. She was amazing, you know, like because for me, it's a big deal. It's my first project, and I'm starting right away in Disney. It's the biggest league, you know? So she was able to give me a great guidance. And because all of this, you know, I believe I did a good job because the help of everybody. And I'm very happy that how it went.
The Falcon and the Winter Soldier already got great reviews too. George St. Pierre, thank you for joining. You are amazing as always, and best of luck in the future.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Take care, George.
Matt, as much as I wish George success in Hollywood, and if he ever returns to fighting, I think my major goal with George St. Pierre is just to hang out with that guy. You can't help but just fall in love with him. And I want to hang out at his house because it is literally like a museum. I want to see those samurai swords. I want to see those dinosaur heads in person. Dude was just awesome. And my favorite part of the interview outside of the tour, and I didn't say this in the intro because I didn't want to spoil it too much, but talking about his love of Cobra Kai and Bloodsport and how he called not being able to do the Jean-Claude Van Damme Bloodsport split one of the great failures of his life was just amazing. And I think he meant it. So I guess to each his own. What's important to George St. Pierre, despite this incredible career, he hasn't been able to do the split. Who knew?
Yeah, I mean, I have the utmost respect for him, but I lost a smidgen when I realized he couldn't do the split. You know, I'd only say that to you, Arthur. I'd never say that to his face, but just a smidgen of respect. It would have been nice if he could do the, maybe it's aspirational for the future, I guess.
Yeah, come on, GSP. We expect better from you. No, he was awesome. So GSP, congratulations on all the success. The Falcon and the Winter Soldier is getting fantastic reviews. It's live now on Disney+. Can't wait to see you take over Hollywood, man, and have you back on the show for all the projects I'm sure you'll have coming up. Our next guest, the other end of the superhero universe, the DC end, Marvel's main competition, Zack Snyder's Justice League has literally been the talk of the town. It has been this fable of what is this movie like? Does it even exist? No one knew. And then it finally hit HBO Max, and spoiler alert, it's actually really good. And another spoiler alert, Harry Lennox, my buddy who I've known for a long time, is Martian Manhunter, makes an appearance in multiple scenes, and hopefully he gets a spinoff. Really cool stuff because he's now entering season 9 on the Blacklist. He's been in some incredible projects. One of my favorite movies, Love and Basketball. He plays Sanaa Lathan's dad. But now he's entered the DC universe. And it was fascinating to talk to someone of his caliber, Matt, because here's a guy who's kind of had his hands in everything throughout his career. He talked about his theater career, his TV career, his movie career, but he's entered a whole new world with DC, and I think he really is loving it.
Yeah, I mean, Love and Basketball will always be the peak in my, you know, that stayed in my VHS for a good 2 years. So, you know, that's what I know him as. That's what I'll always know him as, no matter how much success he has going forward. But he'll always be the dad from Love and Basketball to me.
That's his apex moment for you. He's not Matrix 2 and 3, none of those. It's like your dad in Love and Basketball. You are my De Niro. So the other thing that I really loved about him, Matt, is that getting a sense of what it's like on the set of these types of movies. Obviously, you and I have never really gotten to experience what it's like making an Avengers or making a Justice League, but him talking about the first time he met Henry Cavill in Man of Steel, and then what it's like on set of a Justice League where Zack Snyder is directing these superheroes while controlling Black Hawk helicopters flying in the air. Just like to hear a guy of his caliber talking about it like a little kid, I just thought was fascinating. So Harry's a great guy, super talented actor. I think you guys are going to really enjoy this chat. Without further ado, guys, here's Harry Lennox.
Okay, we are thrilled to have on The Endless Hustle today the Martian Manhunter himself, and more importantly, Nathan Wright in Love and Basketball, Mr. Harry Lennox. Thank you for joining, Harry.
It's awesome to be with you, Matt. And you, Arthur, of course.
Yeah, I only said the Love and Basketball thing because it lived in my VHS player from 2000 to 2002. I brought my first girlfriend over, and that was the movie we watched. So thank you for contributing. Yeah.
I'm glad to have been a part of that happy story for you.
Yeah. Well, it ended poorly, but hey.
Whatever. Oh, there you go. Well,
it wasn't all Love and Basketball there.
Yeah, all right, Harry, yeah. I guess we'll congrats on the success of this, you know, Snyder Cut. That's all the rage now. From what I understand, you watched it with your wife at first to see how you looked as a superhero. Your character was well-received from the public. What experience was that like for you? And would your wife tell you if you looked a little wimpish anyway?
I think she prefers me as the Martian Manhunter to my normal look, such as it is. But, you know, I thought that the rendering of that character was beautiful, particularly given how seamless, you know, the whole thing was. So, you know, just to take it back very briefly, I was scheduled to do the Justice League, and I think I was scheduled to do it as Calvin Swanwick, now the Secretary of Defense. And then, you know, things happened. The script by now is pretty well known that Zach was told to cut the script in half. And so I was one of the casualties, so to speak. Probably Fishburne too, you know, some other pals. But that, it turns around, I think because of all of the missteps, and I'm going to put it on, you know, really at the studio level, people who are probably no longer there or no longer in charge. But, you know, without those missteps, I don't think we would have had a 4-hour Martian Manhunter. But just insofar as my experience was, I flew to LA in August. Zach called me up. He likes to call me out of the blue sometimes and spring things on me. And so this is one of those things that was sprung on me. I was excited because I was all set to go to London and then it didn't happen. So when I get a call 4 years later, 3 years later at the time, it was one of those happy things that you never expect. Like it's probably the best thing in my career that I never thought was ever going to happen. I didn't have any inkling that I would wind up as one of the seven. And I hope that it results in him, that is Zach, being able to really finish out his Justice League multiverse idea, because I think it's pretty stunning.
Chalk me up as one of the people who hated the Joss Whedon version. It was awful. I mean, he really butchered that. Joss is, despite all the Me Too stuff going on with him, we'll put that aside, but he's actually a pretty brilliant creative mind and director. And he did such a good job on the Marvel side and then butchered Justice League.
Yeah.
So when I saw Zach's cut this weekend, I was like, wow, 4 hours is long. It was effing great, Harry. He did a great job. And then I knew you were coming on the show. I'm like, where is he going to appear? And I don't want to give too many spoilers, but I was so happy to finally see you. And now that the reaction is what it is, he's going to get to build out his whole universe. So when are you going to start filming your spinoff? That's my question.
Well, I'm ready. I'm ready to get going. I don't know. You know, I think from what I understand, Deb Snyder said that there were no plans yet, you know, and they would see how it goes. But I think it's going well. You know, on the whole Joss thing, you know, and I hear you. I think a lot of people had that response. But it would be almost impossible, I think, for somebody to come in and complete somebody's dream. Do you know what I mean? Like, he didn't hire himself. That is to say, Joss didn't say, hey, why don't I go and wreck this man's vision? He came in, they gave him an assignment. And, you know, I'm sure he did the best he could. He just, it's not his idea. It's not his vision. So, you know, they told him, I'm pretty sure, to say, hey, make this more like the thing you did before with a whole bunch of different ingredients than the ingredients he had. So, you know, I give him a break a little bit. We'll see. Hopefully he'll get a chance to, as you say, create some more, because I think that those things that are his idea, you know, he does fine.
Here's what you realize. Hollywood now is so ADD. They cut everything so short, and you lose so much of the great substance. This is a great example of when you actually put it all in there, how great the storytelling could be. It's got to be so annoying as an artist sometimes when you do see stuff on the cutting room floor that you think, man, how great would this project have been had a lot of more stuff been left in?
I agree with you 100%. I think that, you know, you put it perfectly. The fans, many viewers don't have the attention span that makes actually movies and novels and so forth great, possible, you know, long form storytelling. You know, you go in and you look at something like Lawrence of Arabia. What would the studio do to that today? You know, would they make that an hour and a half movie? You look at
the The Godfather would be like an hour 12.
Exactly. Even something like Papillon, you know, if you ever saw that original Papillon with Steve McQueen and Dustin Hoffman, there's like a 40-minute sequence where McQueen is in a jail cell just by himself, like acting with a cockroach and a plate of food or a bit, like crazy texture, stuff that you know, I live for as a creative myself. But yeah, I you know, I'm a former seminarian, so I'm gonna go and quote what it says. It says in the Bible and the Gospels, I can't remember exactly which one, but it says, all things work together for good to those who love the Lord and are called together according to his purposes. And I love that. So that all of it came together to acquit, to celebrate this vision that Zack Snyder, who is a great artist, somebody who dares to dream big, to think big, to put his vision up there in spite of whatever anybody may say. But there's no question in my mind that this man lovingly created this tremendous world, pulled it right out of his head with the help of some other collaborators. And, you know, actually, I was in the Man of Steel read-through. I was one of the first people to be able to read that first script. And he had storyboards up there. You could see the world that was being created. That's really quite an extraordinary and singular gift that he has. And one of these days, I hope that people recognize him for the artist that he is.
All right, I got a kind of a genre question for you. I'd imagine when they were filming Shawshank, everybody probably knew it was going to be great because it was kind of right in front of them. Franchises like Justice League and Batman versus Superman, there's so much that goes into it, whether it's editing or effects. When you're filming, or even when you read the initial script, is it difficult to know whether you have a home run or not?
Always. You know, I mean, I've been in those movies where, you know, the script was magnificent and the product didn't turn out so great. I've seen mediocre scripts that turn into great movies, you know, and I think it's interesting you ask about the genre. You know, we always think about the Western versus the sci-fi thing, but the real genre is, are you going to have a movie or are you going to have a film, right? A movie is something everybody kind of gives a pass to because you're going in for a visceral experience. And so a lot of that comes down to execution, what the cameraman's doing, what the editor is going to do, what the music is going to do. I mean, I've seen those movies where without the score, it would have just been a mediocre movie. You know, I have movies that I love that are guilty pleasures, such as The Blues Brothers, probably my favorite movie of its type, because the score rocks. And, you know, they're having such a good time. It's not like the deepest, most thoughtful movie of all time, but you go in, and you try to have that experience. So anyway, I think that there is a way to all of the things collaborating together can really create an experience outside of what's on the page. Sometimes you do know that you have something really cool. If you're going to be doing, for example, I did Titus Andronicus with Julie Taymor and Anthony Hopkins and Jessica Lange and them. And you knew it, I knew it was going to be great just because it's Shakespeare. And you're going to have a lot of material to work with. And you've got an ingenious director in Julie Taymor and great actor. So you have a pretty good idea that that's going to be a good movie. When you're with Zack Snyder, you know it's going to be great to look at. You know that there are going to be some really cool lines that he knows that world. So yeah, you know, so most of the time you have a gut. Most of the time that gut plays out, but we don't all get to, you know, I at least in my career, I haven't always had the luxury of picking fantastic projects to be involved in. Sometimes you got to keep the lights on, but you'll take a job.
It's funny you mentioned that. One of those movies, and Matt had joked at the top of this, Love and Basketball, that has become such a beloved movie. And honestly, it's like on list now as one of the greatest sports movies of all time. But every time I see Omar Epps, I've always ripped him. As someone who played basketball his whole life, I'm like, Omar, what was happening there, my man? Was he getting crushed on set?
You know, I didn't see, actually, because I played Monica's father, that is Sanaa Lathan's father, I didn't really get a chance to see Omar play basketball. I saw Sanaa and the girls play, so to speak, but the ladies. But I didn't get a chance to check out his moves on set. And in all honesty, you know, I didn't see the movie when it came out. I've seen it since, you know, and I've enjoyed it. But for a long time, I just never watched any of the movies I did, just because it was, you know, it seemed to me like a little bit egotistical to look at something that you did, you know how it's going to turn out, rather than sort of second guessing my performances. I just prefer to let the work be what it was. But now I watch things, but I cannot comment on Omar Epps's basketball.
So you don't watch your movies? How much of a well-formed, like, how much do you know the product before you, like, after it's filmed, you know, so you don't need to watch it?
I didn't for a while. I watched The Blacklist, though, and I watched the Justice League and Batman, Superman. But most of the time, like if I go to a premiere, I'll watch the movie. You know, I don't go to all the premieres. And so if it happens to be on sometime, you know, I might watch a little bit of things. I just, to me, it really is kind of torturous to look at myself because I invariably wish that they'd taken a different take or that I or chosen a different performance or that I had done something different, you know, but they'll pick something because the sound was good on it or the shot lined up just so, or somebody else's performance on it, you know, but I don't like doing that to myself. So you get what I gave on the day. If people enjoy it, great. If not, I'm likely to agree with them.
By the way, Sanaa did a fantastic job in that movie. She actually looked like a basketball player. But as for the self-consciousness, I totally get it, Harry. My producer, Maddie, who's on right now monitoring this, probably has PTSD from me analyzing my chin angles and double chins and nose angles for the years she's worked with me. So I totally get it.
Yeah. It's tough. I really don't like the way I look frequently. So
join the club, Harry.
That's the great thing about stage, by the way. You don't have to look at yourself in the theater. You just do it.
I have a voice thing on the pod. Like, I don't listen back to most of these podcasts. Like, the voice is really irritable for me. Is that something that you have too, or is it just the look?
Yeah, the voice too. You know what I mean? If I've had a chance to do a let's just say, a voiceover job, reading copy or something like that, then you have to listen because you want to make sure that you hit all the points, that it's the dynamics are right and all of that. But just listening to me talk as Harry, I'll skip it. You know, I'm not, I don't need to hear it, but I'm going to watch this show.
Excellent.
But you know what's funny is you have one of the best voices. When I was watching Justice League, the first time you appear in the movie, you hear your voice, but you don't necessarily see you.
Right.
And I'm just like, freaking Harry Lennox has got such a great voice. Like, you have the greatest pick up a girl in a bar voice ever. Like, I would come up with the Harry Lennox voice. I'd be getting phone numbers left and right with that raspiness. They'd just be like, I'm in. How do I, where's the first date?
Well, you're welcome to borrow my voice anytime, Arthur. the Cyrano de Bergerac thing. I can talk for you.
Can you imagine Harry's voice coming out of my voice box? Like, hello, I'm Arthur Kane. Yeah,
that's Snyder's next movie, man.
That's right. I think you'd be great at it.
Let's talk a little bit about Spader. He is one of the most talented yet enigmatic figures in Hollywood. What's he like behind the scenes?
Lovely person, you know. I mean, I don't know him. We haven't really hung out per se in jazz clubs, although I know he loves jazz and classical music, both, which I love. But working with him is a delight. You know, he's a top-notch professional. He comes prepared. You know, he's ready. He lifts the game up. You know, it's like I always compare it. I remember somebody once said, it was somebody that was on the Yankees, that you would look back and you, Pee Wee Reese or something, he said, and you see Joe DiMaggio in the outfield and you liked your chances. You know what I mean? That's how I feel like being in the scene with Spader or being in the show with him. You know that he's going to be doing something very interesting. You know that the way he's going to nuance a line or a phrase, like his preparation is really, really good. I think working with a great actor, you know, it's inspiring to me. It makes me want to be ready when I go into work, you know? So I try to be prepared and I enjoy working with him. He's pleasant, he knows a lot. His knowledge of the history of acting and theater and film is exhaustive. You know, he strikes me as a very intelligent man. I don't even think he went to college actually, but he's the son of a couple of college professors. I think for a little while, he was a roommate of John Kennedy, John Kennedy Jr. in New York. They're both from the Massachusetts area, obviously. You know, a very bright man, very cordial, very professional, and at the top of his game right now. I think this is the best role that I've seen him ever play, and he plays it with relish.
This is your longest running role. I mean, it's funny because we've talked now Justice League, Love and Basketball, but you look at your IMDb, Harry, there's like 58 things on there, like whatever the number is. When you get to be part of a 9-season and now running project and having that job security, it's got to be a pretty good feeling.
Yeah, I mean, you know, every year I used to do this thing called the Keys to Harry Lennox, Arthur, and I would play piano and tell stories about, you know, things. The guy who would introduce me, a certain Juan Ramirez, used to crack on me because every television show I'd done until now didn't last for very long, if at all. You know, I think Commander-in-Chief did a season. This thing called Dollhouse did a season and a half. Every other thing got knocked out at the pilot or never even aired that pilot. So this was a shock. How do you prepare for 9 years? I thought we would have been lucky to do 5. You know, that's what we were originally shooting for. But we came out hot out of the gate. We've been able to develop a loyal audience. Those are the people who really kept us on. In some ways, like Zach's Justice League, the fans, you know, have been so loyal that they keep us on and they're vocal and they let people know that this show is enjoyed and this show is enjoyed around the world. I'm very proud of that. I managed to fit in a lot of other things while I've been doing that. So I don't feel like I'm just stuck doing only this. You know, I go and play on a show called Billions on Showtime, another great show, great show. I did an episode of Insecure on HBO, might be able to do one more of those and so forth. So, you know, it's been a great time and it gives me the luxury of being able to go and do things that may not, you know, have a lot of money, but somebody's passion. They want to do a project. I did something yesterday for a couple $100 just because this guy remembered me and telling him never to give up when we were doing Stomp the Yard. So that was 15 years ago. This kid at that time said, hey man, do you have any advice? And I said, never give up because it can turn around. And so now he's producing his own projects. And so I was able to go and do things like that, you know, being able to put together projects of my own. I've got 3 movies that I have made that I've been able to finance because of the Blacklist. I've got a performance arts center in Chicago that we are developing now that's going to what I call the Black Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts. We want to get people back to Chicago where there is great cultural history. And this has all been made possible because of the longevity of this show. So I don't look at it as anything other than the blessing that it is. And I get to have a good time working with some of the best actors in the world. We get to pull people right here from the New York stage, other shows, movies. We work with Brian Dennehy, for God's sake. We're working with LaChance right now, who's a Tony Award-winning actress, won the Tony Award for The Color Purple, fantastic. Keisha Lewis, you know, who played Effie in Dreamgirls after Jennifer Holliday. So, you know, these are top-notch people. I'm forgetting a lot of them. I'm not forgetting them, but there's not enough time to talk about all of the wonderful talent that we have the opportunity to work with these terrific writers, and to be able really to dig into a role over the course of several seasons. That's kind of the long form acting where you get to evolve with the character you're playing, where it becomes in some way almost synonymous with who I am. Harold and Harry, you know, have sort of begun to merge in a way over the years, not the same person, but that I got to grow with the role and to sort of have input on it, but still be able just to be an actor for hire. It's really a great luxury.
As an actor, before you're getting the steady paycheck, when you're just auditioning, role to role, failed pilots, what is life like? I've always wondered, is there a concern? How am I going to pay my mortgage? How am I going to put food on the table? How am I going to pay for a kid's education? What is it like at that point?
Yeah, well, it's uneasy many, many times, but this is the life that we have chosen for ourselves. You know, that's the way it's been for thousands of years at this point, where you have a trade or a gag, a specialty. You can tap, dance, you can juggle, and you take that on the road. In the old days, you know, people would go to town and pitch a tent, and there would be a circus. And invariably, somebody in the town would catch circus fever, and they would leave with the circus, and they would find their calling. And so we give up the idea of any kind of security, at least in the early part of our careers, some of us for the entirety of our careers. We give up that sense of safety for this life of passion, where we get to follow the spirits, where we get to become different people. And so that's the payoff, is that we get to put on many hats, put on capes and masks, and that's really the passion. That's why we do it. That's a kind of food that we have. So, you know, it was never at the point where I was destitute and wondering where my next meal was coming from, so to speak, because I always did other things than act. You know, I mean, I would put up a show. I taught school for 8 years in Chicago. You know, I could dig ditches if I had to do it. So I was always doing something. I can't just sit around if there's no work as an actor. And there have been a year or two of dry spell as an actor where I did other things. And so I'm always going to do that. Even if this goes away, I have an intention of going back to school and getting a degree in theology or music or both, language, something like that. I'm a very inquisitive, thirsty person in that way.
That's a good characteristic. Harry, you mentioned Stop the Yard. I think that budget was $13 million. Justice League budget was $300 million. As far as scope, is there a tangible difference on set from, say, the trailer to the finger foods? Does it even feel like the same profession?
No, it does not sometimes, but that is to say, there's a big difference. When you're on one of those huge budget movies, man, The Matrix 2 and 3, Collateral Damage, you know, stuff like that. Those, you're going to get lobsters, crabs, and all kinds of stuff that you want, top loin steak and so forth. Even the craft services, to your point, Matt, is better, generally speaking. But that's okay. You know, like I'm all right with that. Even if you just get a peanut butter sandwich, you know, but you're having a good time and you're getting down and dirty and it's 3 o'clock in the morning and the mosquitoes around. There's something still magical about being able to create this work. And you begin to appreciate, you know, things other than the fringe benefits, even though the fringe benefits are great. And I tell you, being on Zach's set, it's such a sense of calm. You have such time. You know, you get to sort of luxuriate in the process of it, you know, where he's setting up his camera just like he wants it. Everybody's calm. You know that there are millions of dollars being spent on this probably every day, but there's a sense of family in a way that we're all in it together. I really enjoy working on his set. And you know, you appreciate how huge the scale is. I recall in one particular day, we were at Edwards Air Force Base, which is such a large campus that you can see it from space, like literally on the satellite. You can look at Edwards Air Force Base and see it. Rockets are taking off, you know, Lear jets are taking off. A C-17 is hanging in the air waiting for the word from the assistant director at that time, the great Bruce Moriarty, who literally has a walkie-talkie, and he's controlling Black Hawk helicopters and stuff like that for a shot. And they're just hanging in the air waiting for their cue. Like, and you just see this, you're like, my word, this is as big as it gets. And then Superman comes flying in, you know? And I remember at 5 o'clock that day, they played Taps, what they call Colors. And everything stops. Every car that's driving stops, and they play Taps at sunset. And it was the most solemn, beautiful, respectful thing. You just felt proud to be an American. And you just felt, you know, that we have that kind of resource. But even Hollywood will stop everything that it's doing when it's time to give our respect to the troops and to this code that we have here. So anyway, it's wonderful.
By the way, what did you think about the first time you saw Henry Cavill as Superman in the audition?
What can you think? You know, so this is the way that happened. This is another one of my favorite stories. So I literally got fired or cut loose from my agency, big agency. The show Dollhouse had ended. The agent didn't even have the courtesy to call me directly. They made my manager, a girl I went to school with 50 years ago, call me and tell me that I was no longer wanted, you know. And so I'm sitting around, it might be 3 days later, and my new agent calls and says, hey, they're rebooting Superman, and Zack Snyder wants to talk to you on the phone. They want you in the movie. They don't know what role, but they're wondering if you would come and help them audition potential Superman. So it's like, is this a trick question? Of course. You know, are you kidding? So I was over the moon. I go up to the Santa Monica Mountains. They have all these secret little signs that, you know, say stuff like rhinoceros, little code words, and you follow the code up to the mountain to the secret destination. And I pull up to this gravel pit lot, and I see a guy in a honey wagon. This is a tiny little room that they have for actors who are like day players. No big trailer or anything, just a tiny little honey wagon. And I see this dude that's yoked, shaving in a mirror. And so I see, that's gotta be Superman. I didn't know Henry Cavill at the time. I should have, but he finishes shaving. Zack Snyder, Henry Cavill, and me sit down and have some breakfast. We talk about the shots that we're going to be doing. Sun's rising and everything. 5 seconds into it, I was like, man, they don't need to look at any other person on the planet to play Superman, but this guy right here. And so we shot, you know, the little test scene that day. Much of that wound up, the same kind of material wound up being in the movie. I think he's wonderful, wonderful. You know, I grew up, I was a teenager, looking at Christopher Reeve, who I thought was a wonderful, wonderful Superman, really iconic. And Henry was wearing his suit, a suit that was made for the great Christopher Reeve as Superman on that day, on that test day. And I, as far as I'm concerned, he should retire with the role. I think he's fantastic.
Wow. One of the best jawlines in the game too, really.
One of the best.
One of the best jawlines, really.
Oh, man, and right?
You can't beat it.
Second only to mine, Matt.
Of course. Says the guy who can't even look at himself.
Harry's like, you know what? If Henry doesn't work out, you got me right here.
I'm your Huckleberry.
What's been like the fan response? Have people just been like hitting you up on Twitter?
You know, I see things that come up on like Google alerts. You know, I get it. They'll have pictures sometimes of me as the Martian Manhunter and side to side and that. I haven't been overwhelmed really here by a fan response, but you know, people are proud. I think that's the most common reaction, response from friends. I get letters from Australia. I get letters, you know, from my friend Lockie Hume and so forth. People I haven't heard from years that say, hey, big surprise to see you on the screen. Are you going to get your own spinoff movie and all of these things? It's been fun. It's all upside. There's nothing but upside on it. I don't think I'm a household name or anything today, but you know, I'm sure that a lot of people have seen it. And insofar as they might be able to recognize me outside of that beautiful makeup, you know, great. But I haven't. My life didn't change yet, so I'll keep.
You don't have a favorite meme or anything?
I haven't seen any. You know, I'm not as savvy as you young lads.
Yeah, you seem like an old school guy. So sorry for insulting you with the question.
I'll ask my young assistants what they've seen.
Harry, if you don't mind, I'm going to hit you with a listener submission question here.
Yes.
This one's from the guys over at Postcred Pod, really entertaining entertainment podcast. They say, Harry, seeing you get to finally appear as Martian Manhunter in the Snyder Cut was awesome, especially since you've been in the franchise since Man of Steel. But I got to ask, why wouldn't Martian Manhunter intervene sooner? Superman and Zod leveled downtown Metropolis in Man of Steel, and your superpowered alien character, who definitely could help the situation, is literally right there.
This is a great question. One that I think I asked Zach himself on like an IGN broadcast. Was Calvin Swanwick all along Martian Manhunter? Has he been doing this for years, or did he just assume that shape? Just, you know, for a short period of time, say, for example, only in the Justice League, right? And this gets into all kinds of stuff like acting theory. You know, what does the actor playing the character know? How much should or can they know? Is it important that they know everything? It also gets into theological questions. For example, since these are kind of demigods, these characters, superheroes, supernatural, almost godlike figures, why would a good God, an omnipresent, omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent God, not intervene and allow evil to take place in the world? You know, some people, some atheists, for example, might say, well, that proves that there is no God, or if there is one, then he's not all powerful. It could be, and this is where I go, is that he may have sufficient reason not to be involved. I take the position that he does get involved. He tries to save Superman in his position at that point as the Secretary of Defense. He's on the phone with the president of the United States against, you know, as he watches this man try to defeat Doomsday, which is an impossible figure to defeat. In fact, it kills Superman. So I think that he does try to help. If it is insufficient for many of the fans of this character, Martian Manhunter, why have you been sitting around? We don't know what he does when he's not on screen. He may be out saving the world from hunger. He may have issues to deal with on Mars. So, you know, he may have sufficient reason not to have been involved until this very moment, that there was some good reason that he needed to not get involved with these other six characters until this very moment. There was no Superman until the last minute, right? In the Justice League. We have to wait around a couple of hours for Henry to resurrect, as it were. And so now that there are seven of them, now is perhaps the time. We can retcon any number of things if there is an opportunity to do another one of these where that is explained satisfactorily. But it is a good question, but I think that there's probably a sufficient answer for it.
I want to switch gears for a second, Harry. How much fun did you have watching The Last Dance?
I mean, in a COVID time, it was a feast for the eyes. You know, I waited with bated breath every time you had to wait a little bit longer. I would store them up sometimes to watch 3 hours in a row. But, you know, I was in Chicago at that time, the first three-peat. I was there, you know, working on stage and teaching school in Chicago, and the pride that we had in our city, knowing that we had Superman right there in Chicago, that he'd had to bide his time before he could get the team and the system and the coach in place to display the greatness that was Michael Jordan and his cohorts, frankly, Scottie Pippen, Bill Cartwright, Craig Hodges, you know, Horace Grant, Dennis Rodman, you know,
Bill Wennington, baby. Don't forget about Bill.
Man, they had, I think, still, if that team, and I'm talking about the first three-peat, 92, 93, 94 team could come back and play today, they would sweep the league. As currently constructed, with all the juice, without all of the you know, the little tricks of the trade that they have, the advances in this, in sports science, where people can recover from Achilles heel tears. I mean, my God, what they can do now. Can you imagine if they had access to that kind of technology, medicine, nutrition, all of these things? But I think even as they were, they could beat any team in the year. But anyway, watching it, going back, and you know, it's rose-colored glasses a little bit. It really is Michael's story. They probably didn't, you know, say all of the stuff that they could have said that might have detracted from it, but I'm glad they didn't. I think that kind of, I wouldn't even call it revisionist history, but I think, you know, the nostalgia that it brought up was a bomb in a very difficult time last year when we got that gift of The Last Dance. What a wonderful title, and what a wonderful series to go back and dream again.
Would you ever see Jordan around town? Any run-ins?
You know, one time, Arthur, he came to see a show I was in. I was doing in 97. It was the summer of 97. I think it was after, you know, they'd won already. Anyway, he came to see a play, Mount Rainey's Black Bottom, which now Chadwick Boseman, God rest his soul, has been nominated for. But I was playing that character on stage. And Michael Jordan and his wife at the time, Juanita Jordan, came to see it. And because he's Jordan, he couldn't wait in the audience, you know, and hang out in the out in the foyer and have a soda. They had to bring him backstage because he's Jordan. So we saw him at intermission. And of course, we were all over the moon. And he looked at, you know, he looked at us as he was being ushered through. And he said, hey, man, you know, really good show. Really, really good show. And of course, I would go and see him at, you know, the United Center. And somebody, I never really had the chance to engage with him. But that one time, that's all I need. That's all I ever did. Is if he thought that we were, he was being entertained by something we were doing. And it seemed to be the least I could do after all the entertainment and pride that he brought to us. So also Al Gore came that season to see that show. The vice president at the time, Al Gore, they came with the police, with the Secret Service dogs and all of that stuff in preparation. He came with the mayor, Mayor Richard Daley at the time, and his wife, who's also no longer with us, the great Maggie Daley. But yeah, you know, that was a time I'll never forget. He was wearing a beautiful purple suit too, by the way.
Wow. Harry, is there an actor or actress that you want to work with in the future, the kind of white whale?
Yeah, you know, I've had a chance to work with some real titans in it. I would love to work with Robert De Niro. You mean?
I've heard of him. Yeah.
Yeah, he'd be great. I've never had the opportunity to work with Meryl Streep yet. Yeah, I'd like to work with Robert De Niro and there's a number of people that I would love to get a chance. I'd like to do something with Sam Jackson. We were in a movie together once, but didn't get a chance to work with each other in that scene. I mean, so many. But he's my number one. I had a chance to do some work with the great Al Pacino. We didn't film it, but, you know, did some stage readings with him. And so I feel like, you know, I did do that one. And frankly, you know, if I ever get a chance to, I'd like to work with Sylvester Stallone. I think that would be a kick.
Yeah, me too.
You actually got to work with my all-time favorite, Gene Hackman. What was Hackman like?
Hackman was top pro, man. Hackman is from Danville, Illinois. Gene Hackman. Same town as Dick Van Dyke and Bobby Short and some other very interesting people. This little town, Danville. This was the package. And so this is like my first feature. I might have been 23 or something like that. And there was a scene where at the last minute, the director, the great Andy Davis, guy from my neighborhood in Chicago, whose father, Nate Davis, is a classic Chicago actor. A lot of people would remember him. But Andy was like, hey, man, you know, you guys just lost a comrade soldier here. I need one of you to cry. Harry, you cry. Camera, roll, action. And so I could, you know, that's a hard kind of build to fill. And so Hackman stopped the cut. He said, he went over to Andy and said, hey, man, you know, this kid's over here. He's trying to create, generate some emotion. Give him a couple minutes, for God's sake. And so he laid into the director a little bit. I had the time to sort of, you know, take my moment and get prepared. And so I remember him looking out for his fellow actors. And so one day, you know, because I played one of his foot soldiers and we were all big fans of Gene Hackman. My God, what a great actor, what a great American actor. So I did my impersonation of him from Superman. I said, do you know why the number, I said, Otis, do you know why the number 200 is so vitally descriptive for both of our lives? Because it's your weight and my IQ. Now think, people, think. And so he said, where's that from? Superman? I did a better impersonation at the time. But he laughed and he thought it was cute.
That could have gone either way. He could have been like, this kid's done, fire him. Or he's like, cast him as my co-star in the next Hackman movie.
That's right. But I was a cheeky kid at the time, I have to tell you.
I take some balls, Harry.
How do you end up crying? Like, I've always kind of wondered that. I heard that someone puts something in your eye and that kind of gets the tears down. But as an actor, are you able to cry on demand? Are you like, I would think of my grandma. I don't know. How do you do it?
Yeah, stuff like that. You know, we have a process that we refer to as sense memory. But there are literally people who can, I have a friend who's a doctor named Mark Arnett, neurosurgeon or something crazy like that, who can cry if you just say, hey, man, cry for me right now. And he just cry. I don't think he thinks about a damn thing. But we frequently go through what we call sense memory, where you recall something from your past. Or in my case, whenever it's necessary, you know, I can just think of the situation at hand, think of something. Or, you know, put yourself in the moment of the reality, the emotional reality of it. You know, in reality, Matt, we won't, in life, people don't try to cry, they try not to cry. And so it really is in playing that opposition that you find all of the drama necessary. I don't think I've seen De Niro produce tears when he's playing, when he's playing a very sad moment. Only very rarely did I ever see Brando do it. There's one scene in The Godfather when he's on the bed and Michael Corleone comes and says, I'm with you now, Pop. I think you see the trickle of a tear. But in most cases, the tears are not necessary. But if necessary, if required, they can put glycerin in your eye. I've never done it. I haven't found that necessary yet. But there's all sorts of tricks that we have.
Wait a minute, glycerin, like nitroglycerin?
I don't know. It's like a glycerin tablet, sort of like a liquid form of Vaseline in a way, or whatever it is. But yeah, they put it in, causes you to tear up, to make sure nasal passages, all that stuff run, and you can have those tears if they are desired.
I got to ask you about the Andy Dalton signing. Are you jumping off a building because of that?
I'm very excited about it. You know, I think, by the way, I thought Mitchell Trubisky was a very good athlete. I'm wishing him success in all of that. But yeah, you know, I mean, I think we're still in the hunt for some other players. Russell Wilson, I've heard this name bandied about. I'm excited. I think that it all comes down to chemistry in many ways. But I think, you know, with the right chemistry, in the right team, the Bears have a chance to do quite well, particularly in their division. And you know, who knows? Who knows what you're going to get anymore? There's a lot at play right now in the NFL. Players going, you know, Wentz, I think, is going to Indianapolis. This is going to be interesting. There's a lot of people on the trading blocks, and I'm curious as to what it'll all shake out to be. I really want to see what's going to go on with the Patriots as well, you know.
You must have the rosiest outlook of any human being ever, because I think all of Chicago, there's a lot of depression happening right now with the Andy Dalton signing.
Hey, it all comes down to chemistry. I really think that, right? You know, some person in one system can flourish. And I don't know. I mean, I've been cynical about the Bears. I was one of the people who didn't, you know, wasn't crazy about their picks in the past. But I think that I think it's a good team. And I think that, you know, the Bears can do a lot with just their grit and determination. And I think we'll be okay in that division.
Harry, one more before we let you go. Here on The Endless Hustle, our mission is to discover how figures at the top of their profession continue to elevate. You've been in the biz for 3 decades. How do you continue to evolve your mindset both on and off the screen?
I like to cross-reference other disciplines in order to feed my acting. So I do a fair amount of study on natural sciences, history, theology, music. And so I think in many ways, it's by not focusing on the thing at hand. Sometimes you can see things better in the peripheral view than you can by looking at it and focusing on it all of the time. That's really how I've done it, by knowing that those actors who I admire the most aren't always thinking about acting, aren't always obsessed with it, thinking about their careers and so forth, but that are living their lives, and I'm observing people and are engaging with people on a very one-on-one, very real basis, soul to soul, so to speak. So for me, that's the way I do it. And then you can tap into those things, or you can find references that will help in the acting. Really, the entire world is our field of study in real time. That's if you're really good at it, I think you can kind of develop a style that you can rely on all the time, but that you have these other references because you actually are looking at people in real life. We, in some ways, Matt, we abdicate our lives as personal beings, because we're always, or at least our job when we're in execution of our duties, is being something other than ourselves. And so that's a really strange balancing act. I wrote an essay not long ago for a publication that talks about activism, what I call activism, activists, social activists and so forth, who are actors, and whether that's even possible. Because, you know, our job is to do whatever we're paid to do. That's really our duty. That's our sacred duty. And so, you know, for me, when I take on that role or that job, I have to rely on things outside of myself in order to perform that job. I achieve that, I hope, or am achieving it in terms of my evolution by observing real life and by being engaged in it on the level that I can.
Brilliant. Harry Lennox, thank you for joining us. You were awesome.
Hey, man. Great to be with you.
If Morgan Freeman is unavailable to narrate my life, Harry, you're getting a call.
Well, listen, I'll have him kidnapped just so I can do that. Just so I can narrate it for you. And don't give up on Andy Dalton.
Harry, always great seeing you, my man. Congrats. And hopefully I'll see you at the Martian Manhunter premiere.
Wouldn't that be great? I'll see you there.
All right, folks, hopefully you enjoyed that Harry Lennox chat. Matt, here's the craziest thing. When you're listening to Harry Lennox, I felt like we were taking a college course in how to be a thespian. It's just like acting 101.
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy who approaches it as a profession. I think a lot of times, like, guys like us will look at it and be like, wow, they're playing make-believe, but like there is actually a scientific process that goes into this and how you approach, you know, the job day in and day out. And he, like I said, he's been around for, you know, since the 80s. So he's been doing this for a long time. He has his methods that work. He's tasted the fame, but now he does it for the love of the profession. And I think that is obvious in the interview.
Yeah, and by the way, came from very humble beginnings, hardworking actor, had normal careers, and just kind of worked his way up and made it. And now Blacklist is one of the biggest network shows on TV. He's part of one of the biggest movie events of the year. So couldn't think of a better guy. I've known Harry for a long time. Couldn't think of a better guy to be experiencing all this success. And he's also giving it back through his theater company, through mentoring young actors. So great job, Harry. You are the man. And congrats on the Martian Manhunter role in Zack Snyder's Justice League, which is now available on HBO Max. All right, guys, that's it for another episode of Endless Hustle. Hit them with the plugs, Matt.
All right, plugs. Subscribe to Endless Hustle wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also look at Bro Bible's YouTube channel where we're posting the interviews. Be sure to keep up with the latest in sports, entertainment, and lifestyle on social media at Bro Bible. That's on Instagram and Twitter. And follow the Endless Hustle accounts as well, at Endless _Hustle on Twitter and at Endless Hustle Pod on Instagram. And follow my personal account, please. I need you to, at Mr. Kohan, K-E-O-H-A-N. And Arthur?
I am at Arthur Cade on Twitter and at It's Me, Arthur Cade on Instagram. We are back with an electric episode on Thursday. Eric Andre, who has quickly become one of the funniest and most popular comedic actors in Hollywood. And by the way, Matt, right after we interviewed him for Bad Trip, his new movie on Netflix, it was the number one movie on Netflix all weekend. So congratulations, Eric Andre. Remember, we talked about that Netflix money. and getting your $10 million home. Hopefully our juju spread to that number one ranking, and you'll invite us to your house at some point so we can see it. And then also our buddy, friend of the show now, I think I can call Shep Rose a friend of the show. We love that guy. Southern Charms Shep Rose. He has a brand new book out. We talked all about writing the book, his experiences on Southern Charm, and more. I think you guys are going to really enjoy this episode. So we'll see you back on Thursday with Eric Andre and Shep Rose. See y'all then.
Peace.